This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Claire McDonnell and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. Hello and welcome to Woman's Hour. I'm Claire McDonnell, taking care of things for the next few days. Great to have your company. Coming up, today marks 2 years since the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in Iran. She'd been arrested by the country's morality police for allegedly not wearing a hijab properly and died in police custody. Her death sparked nationwide protests and the birth of the Women Life Freedom Movement. We'll hear from the BBC Verified journalist Reha Kansara about her new reporting on the women who continue to speak out and the horrific consequences they are still suffering. Writer, comic, theatrical impresario, TV host, weekend chainsaw wielder, we'll get into that shortly, Sandy Toksvig is a woman who defies pigeonholing, and she continues in that vein with her new novel, Friends of Dorothy. It's a story that explodes the expectations around how older women should behave and what family should look like. Sandy joins me in the studio and she's joining me ahead of her book tour. She's a big advocate of those unexpected encounters that can be life-changing if you just get out of the house and connect with people. So I want to hear from you this morning. Has that happened to you? Maybe a chance conversation on a bus that had a major impact on you, a connection made in an unexpected way that opened up a whole new adventure in your life. You can text the programme. The number is 84844. We're on social media at BBC Woman's Hour, and you can email us through our website. You can send us a WhatsApp message as well. This is the number you need, 03700 100 444. Also, we'll mark the halfway point in one of the most important intergenerational studies into breast cancer. Pay tribute to the groundbreaking ballerina Michaela Mabinti de Prince after her death at the age of just 29. Also, live music in the studio from West End Wonder Woman Carrie Hope Fletcher, star of Les Mis and Cinderella, who's about to head out on tour. All that on the way on Woman's Hour. But let's start here. It's a very important anniversary today. It marks 2 years since the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in Iran. She'd been arrested by the country's morality police for allegedly not wearing her hijab properly and died in police custody. Her death sparked nationwide protests. I'm joined by BBC Verified journalist Reha Kansara, who's been speaking to women in Iran who claim to have been spied on by the authorities, leading to threats and beatings. Reha, welcome.
Hi.
Before we get into your new reporting, let's talk about how women in Iran, and maybe men too, have been marking this second anniversary.
So, since the death of Mahsa Amini, who died in 2022, there were immediately after protests that shook the nation, which were met with harsh clampdowns by the government, arrests, beatings, even executions and killings. That has dissipated, and what we're seeing now is a more subtle civil disobedience that's taking place online and on the street. So you have protests happening or social media posts in protest against the state being public, being publicized online, but also you have women on the streets who are defying the hijab, the headscarf that they wear over their head to cover their hair, which is a symbol of solidarity with Mahsa Amini, who was killed by the, well, not killed, but she was killed, she was, sorry, she passed whilst in police custody 2 years ago.
Yes, because it's important to say the police say it was still nothing to do with them. There were many people who would think contrary to that. So do women not take to the streets? It's what you're saying, because of this really vicious clampdown, are they finding different ways to protest?
Exactly. I mean, there have been bursts of small protests happening since 2022, but nothing on the scale that we saw immediately after Mahsa's death. In the few months after her death, upwards of 20,000 protesters, according to experts I've spoken to, were arrested. Now, we don't know how many of them were arrested for their social media posts, but there was a real clampdown by the state and by the authorities to quash dissent.
Yeah, and we hear it's being reported a number of female prisoners at a Tehran jail went on hunger strike to mark this anniversary. What more do we know about that?
So we know that Evin prison is notoriously known for holding political prisoners that are against the state, seen against the state. This is just one of many things that have been happening since the two-year anniversary began. The Persian calendar marks the two-year anniversary as 15th, obviously, here. Generally, it was the 16th where news came around that she passed. So we've seen protests across the globe, more so in the sense of vigils and commemorations, rallies in Europe. Women continue to defy by not wearing the hijab. A lot of people are posting on social media, and not just women, but men too, because this movement, the Women Life Freedom Movement, started off as one that was in solidarity with women who were being, supposedly beaten or killed by the state, to now it's broadened out to now encompass a movement that's anti-establishment in Iran.
Now, you have been back to mark the second anniversary. You've gone back. You've spoken to a number of women who were caught up in this, arrested for social media posts for not wearing the hijab. And there's pretty graphic testimony. Tell me what you found.
So we spoke to, in total, five people, four women and one man. There were two women who we featured quite heavily in our reporting. One woman, we're calling her Alif. We've kept her name a secret for safety. But she was arrested after a post she uploaded onto social media in which her hair, she was walking through the streets of Tehran at night and she wasn't wearing her hijab. Usually what you'd see in photos is if women aren't wearing their hijab, which is basically a scarf, they're keeping it around their neck. She hadn't even placed it around her neck. So she was wearing, a T-shirt, no hijab, and she was walking through the streets of Tehran and she posted this photo on social media, which was then picked up by the authorities. When it was picked up by the authorities, she was eventually arrested and interrogated, taken to a place, an unknown place, where she was kept in solitary confinement. They tried to force confessions out of her. And eventually she was charged with propaganda against the state. She received a suspended sentence, but not just a suspended sentence. She was, part of that was lashings. She was lashed over 50 times. She says that she didn't want to show weakness, but it was very, very painful. She kept it in.
How has life been for her since? I mean, clearly she felt strongly about it, but I guess these kind of punishment beatings are also a warning. Don't repeat that. Has she not protested since? What's happening with
it's
that?
A really strong warning, and she has gone quiet. She can't protest so visibly in the way that she did, because if she does, she has a suspended sentence, and that sentence could be invoked. So she has gone quiet, but she has also spoken about, she's compared the Women Life Freedom Movement and her position in it. She's compared it to the seeds of a flower. A flower can bloom and blossom, but when it dies, its seed spreads and it can still bloom and blossom and flower in different ways.
Are women under surveillance then? And if they are, how is that happening?
Not just women, everyone, or a lot of people, are under surveillance in Iran. It's happening in various forms. I mean, the surveillance system in Iran predates, 2022. In fact, before the advent of the internet, surveillance happened in different ways. There were systems in place where volunteers and neighbors could just dob in on their fellow, citizens. Mm-hmm. But with the advancement of technology and social media, it's become much more pervasive. So what we have are cyber police systems in place that can monitor people that they want to track. Allegedly, Iran uses phishing techniques to hack people's phones and data. Internet shutdowns have happened in the country, and this has not just happened in immediately after 2022 protests, but it's happened in 2009 and 2019 when there were other protests in the country. More importantly, though, we've seen the building, or reportedly the building, of an app called Nazar, which allows the police and vetted volunteers to report women who are not wearing the hijab. So essentially, you can be out on the road, and if you're not wearing a hijab, a police member or a volunteer can take a photo of you, or, you know, if you're in
a car.
It's
all very joined up. It's all very joined up by the sounds of things. I know you tried to contact the government. What response did you get?
Well, they didn't really say anything to us. We put all our allegations that were made to us by the experts and the women that we spoke to, but they didn't get back to us at all.
Reha, thank you so much. Very important journalism here. BBC Verified journalist Reha Kansara. You can read more about Reha's reporting from BBC Verify. You can find that on the BBC News website. Thank you for dropping by. Now, you will know my next guest from many of the millions things she's been found time to do over the years, whether it's presenting QI, campaigning for gender equality and LGBTQ plus rights, founding a political party, or simply making us laugh. Sandy Toksvig is here to talk about her new novel, Friends of Dorothy, which explodes gender norms around age and relationships, about the family you create rather than the one you are given. Sandy, welcome back to Woman's House.
Yeah, it's so nice to be here.
It's great to have you here. I have the book here, Friends of Dorothy. Let's talk about the title, a well-known expression. What does it mean in the context of your novel? Which is very witty, by the way.
That's very kind. It's meant to make you laugh. I had a friend read it on a train, said it should come with a volume control. Laughing too much. So it is an expression that, I don't know if it's still in use, that used to be used for gay people. But in this instance, it is an actual character called Dorothy and the people who are friends with her. She's a 79-year-old, foul-mouthed, cantankerous, extremely energetic woman who does not believe that age is anything but a number. She sells her house to a young couple, young lesbian couple. And when they go to move in, she fails to move out.
Yes.
And comedy ensues.
It certainly does. And the inspiration for Dorothy, do you see any of yourself in her, your future self?
I would like to be Dorothy. She really doesn't give up. She's still working as a minicab driver. She's quite happy to use a sledgehammer to knock things down. I'm 66 years old. Yesterday, I spent all day with a chainsaw out in the woodland. I don't see any reason why we feisty old ladies shouldn't just carry on be feisty.
We'll get into that in a moment, but it was perfectly legal. I understand what you were doing with the chainsaw.
It was entirely legal, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent.
No one was harmed.
Let's come back. Maybe a little bit of undergrowth. Let's come back to the characters and the young gay couple who are drawn so beautifully in your book. And you make a point of saying that family that they have here is sometimes logical, not biological. So what does that mean in the context of the LGBTQ plus community and the message you were trying to convey?
I think it is actually true for all of us, but certainly within the gay community, it is still sadly a case where, because of cultural reasons or all kinds of reasons, some people are removed from their families when they come out. And then they have to create their own. And often it's extremely successful. Now, as it happens, I have a very loving biological family, but I also have a huge logical family. And I think that's true of many of us. My friends are part of my family. And I don't know if that happened to you, but I certainly noticed after lockdown, my friends and I now say, I love you, to each other in a way that we just didn't do before. And we are dependent on each other. I'm so lucky. I have a close circle of friends who I could call from anywhere in the world if I needed them. And I wanted to pay tribute to that kind of family. So, you know, I'm sure we all have members of our biological family that we'd happily divorce, but we can't. But our logical family is the one that we choose, and it's the one that we probably get an enormous amount of energy from. And so the book is a tribute to that, and not just for gay people, I think for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, how sad does that make you that we still have to talk about, we still have to use the phrase coming out and the impact that that makes on an individual, should they then be rejected or otherwise by their own flesh and blood?
But I think that's the saddest thing, is that there's a risk that you might be rejected. And that really breaks my heart. Now, I came out, I think it is in fact the anniversary of 30 years ago. And it was considered shocking. I didn't know any other gay people. I didn't know anybody who was there to support me. I had very little support from anybody in public life. I like to think things have changed because we can now get married, which is wonderful. But I'm afraid that is not the case. There are still people who are really suffering. Mental health stats for people in the LGBT plus community are not good. I wanted to write a heartening book, but it's not a book written for just for gay people to read. It's a book, hopefully, for anybody. It's just the characters happen to be gay.
Do you think then we are at a point in society when there's a lot of visibility for gay people, gay issues, and there's an awful lot of pride, but it's only skin deep?
Well, you now can see companies that are beginning to say, I'm not going to take part in diversity programs anymore. We can see some backlash, and I really worry about it. And I feel honor bound. I mean, I'm a grandmother now. I would have loved if a grandmother had stood up and said, I'm on your side. And I am. With every breath I draw, until I can't draw breath anymore, I will stand up for the community and say, I'm here for you.
Mm. And your own experience of coming out, I mean, I know that you had a lot of warnings, didn't you? People said, this will finish your career.
Oh, not just my career. I was going to entirely wreck the fabric of society. I mean, what I wasn't going to be able to do. And my children would turn out to be complete nightmares and so on. And I now have three fabulous grown-up children in their 30s who are incredible members of society. I have three grandchildren, one on the way. None of the things that were predicted have in fact happened, but you still have to keep standing up. I was just spent a year last year as a fellow at Christ's College in Cambridge, and we had the very first LGBT dinner there, and a young man came up to me, built like a sort of rugby player, looked like he could easily defend himself. And at this dinner, he said to me, this was the first time in his life he had felt he could be himself. So, you know, work to do.
It's the first dinner
Of
that nature that they'd had there.
At that college, yes.
Right.
Yeah, but good on them for having it.
Good on them for having it, yeah. What do you think needs to change? If you had the ear of people, we have a new government now, what would you say should be on their agenda to change? It's cultural, obviously. It's cultural. There's only so much that the people like you can do or governments can do. But what would you put in their inbox?
I don't think there are things that you can legislate. I think the thing that we need to look at is the poison on social media, I'm afraid. I think there's so much polarity and there's so much ridiculous nonsense spouted on social media. I see there's a school organization that has decided to ban phones for kids. I think that's probably not a bad idea. I'm about to go out on tour, and one of the reasons is I think we should meet each other in person. We should stop shouting on the internet and stop shouting via social media and actually sit down and look each other in the eye and say, all right, talk to me, tell me about your life. You cannot know what it is like to be a marginalized person if you have never experienced that yourself. So sit with somebody who has been and let them tell you their story.
It's so powerful, isn't it? And you make, I know I've seen interviews that you've given where you say you go, you love going around the country because you love that connection it gives for yourself with people in front of you. But also the fact that people are coming together in a space that they probably would never have met that person otherwise.
Well, that's the wonderful thing. You're going to sit next to, it's random, right? You sit next to somebody who you've never met before. And I always say to the audience, listen, in the interval, don't just go to the toilet and have a drink and so on. Talk to somebody that you don't know. I mean, don't be weird, you know. Try not to be aggressive. but it might be the love of your life, or it might be your new best friend, or it might be somebody with something interesting. Well, the thing I know every day is how much I don't know. And I enjoy every day learning something. So in that sense, I think I'm still a bit of a Pollyanna. I still think the best is yet to come.
It's so lovely to hear that the people, when you've thrown that out and you've said, give us some examples. You said, who's got the strangest job in this auditorium? What did you get back on that?
Oh, I mean, all kinds of things. So I had a very old man said, I'm the oldest handmade bicycle maker left in Britain. And he was very elderly. And so he spoke for about 5 minutes and we heard about that. And that was fascinating. Anyway, I said, thank you so much. And I moved on to the next question. He came down, he banged on the stage with his hand and said, I hadn't finished. I said, I'm so sorry. So I got a chair and a cup of tea and let him do another 10 minutes.
Can't argue with him. He's a historical figure. Also, the longest baby in Lancashire.
We did have the longest baby in Lancashire. I get asked all sorts of things. I had a woman in Bradford ask me my bra size, and I couldn't remember, so she had to come up and have a look. So, it's varied.
It's a two-way street.
It's extremely varied.
We've been asking the Woman's Hour listenership. Julie has got in touch to say this. I met a man at a bus stop. We found out we lived on the same road. He invited me onto his quiz team with his wife and others. I'm recently bereaved. and husband worked for Radio 4, actually. So it was amazing to have such a fun evening full of laughs.
But isn't that great? You know, yes. I live out in the country since lockdown, and we moved about 3 years ago. We have a fantastic group of friends, of local people, who some we've met by chance and who've introduced us to other people. And this is a circle of people that I hadn't known were going to be so important to me. So it's there, but we have to open the door and go out.
Mm. And this takes us back to the chainsaw. Is this
yes.
You're talking about?
This is my chainsaw group.
Chainsaw use at the weekend.
Yes, so branch managers.
Very good.
Branch managers. Actually, one of them's a policeman. He's our special branch manager.
Of course he is.
But it isn't just the boys. It's their partners. It's their children. We had 2 girls of 13 who were helping in the woodland yesterday.
What do you do in the woodland with the chainsaws then?
So it's 40 acres of ancient woodland, which urgently needs restoring. It's been neglected for 3 or 4 generations. It's being choked to death by holly. And we are, bit by bit, restoring it. And I have to say, we were clearing a new footpath on Sunday. And when the light shines down onto the forest floor, because you have cleared such terrible undergrowth and awful dead trees that don't need to be there, we just stand and cheer, all of us. It makes us feel good. So, that's my little environmental bit that I'm doing.
And I know you love being out in nature. You love where you live.
Yeah.
Why is that so important to you? Because you're somebody who clearly needs people, is energized by being around people. As you say, there's all those conversations you haven't yet had. But why do you need both in your life?
Because I think we literally need to be grounded. I mean, we talk about being grounded, but it's that. It's paying attention to the earth. Stand still for a minute. You know, one of the best pieces of advice somebody gave me when they knew I was going to start restoring this woodland, they said, find your sitting spot. Find the bit where you just sit and listen to the woods and you just hear the birds and you watch the, you know, we have 6 species of bats, watch the bats. Or the deer gave birth in the meadow this spring and they have twins and I occasionally catch sight of them, but only if I take a minute. Take a minute and sit still. Draw a breath. Look into the distance. Calm your mind. And it makes me feel better. And hopefully we're creating a space where lots of people can feel better.
And people often do that, but they take their phones with them, the phones in the pocket when they go out on the walk.
Yeah. No. Leave it. Leave it alone. Sit still. Take a breath. It's good for all of us. And the wonderful thing in this country, it is available everywhere. You know, we do still have fantastic parks, thanks to the Victorians. That's something I would say to the government. Please, can you create more open space for people? But there is some access, and there's volunteering. The Woodland Trust do amazing volunteering. So there's something we can all do.
And not only are you resetting in your book, family relationships, the views maybe people have of older women, you're also trying to take on the internet and Wikipedia with how we understand and reflect ourselves through all of those search engines, Wikipedia being one of them that we use a lot. You've been involved in this fascinating project at Cambridge University. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the reason I wrote Friends of Dorothy Weirdly is because I'd written a book before which could not be published. So I sat down to write an atlas of how women are doing around the world because I thought maybe it would be good to have an overview of what's happening. And I was commissioned to write 80,000 words. When I got to 220,000 words, I thought this is probably not a book. And also it'll go out of date as soon as I publish it. I wonder if it's an internet thing. Now, Wikipedia is a serious problem for us. It is the largest collection of knowledge in humanity's history. It is, because of the way it's sourced, 85% by and about white men. Now, if we carry on with this and AI scrapes that data, what will happen is that women and other groups will be left out of history. So I mentioned this on stage at the Festival Hall. There was a professor in the audience. She said, come to Cambridge. I went to Cambridge the whole of last year to work on the Mapamundi project, the map of the world, and to see if we can't create an app where you could literally hold the world in your hand. And it will be curated by women around the world to tell us what their lives are like, because we cannot know sitting here, and it's not for us to tell. I have high hopes that we're going to get funding. We've already got office space and it will expand into a massive project. So the idea is to, change the world, I think.
That is a huge undertaking, isn't it? But so it's not just historical, because obviously Wikipedia is often just like, who was this person?
No.
What did they do? This is what's life like now.
What's going on now? And we need to know, you know, what's happening in Afghanistan to the women is so breathtakingly distressing. But there is still news coming out. There's, if I might recommend, Rukshana Media, who tells stories by Afghan women now to the rest of the world. We have to do something. And if we don't, as I say, we'll have a very skewed version of what's actually happening out there.
Thank you so much for dropping by again.
Oh my goodness, it was
studio.
So nice to meet you.
And you. Well, we met in person.
I know, right?
We had a conversation. That's what it's all about. Friends of Dorothy is a great read by Sandy Toksvig. It's published on the 26th of September. And Sandy is touring the UK until the 15th of October. You're also hosting, it says, the QI-inspired live show, One Night Only at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane for two nights only.
I know, it's a
What's
weird
that
title.
I don't know. Well, twice the opportunity to see you. 13th and 14th of November. And I believe everybody gets a free copy of this. They come and see you on the tour.
They do, yeah.
Excellent. Sandy, thank you for dropping by.
It's a pleasure.
You are listening to Woman's Hour on BBC Radio 4. Do keep your texts coming in of those random encounters that we were just talking about there with Sandy. 84844. Some lovely stories coming in here. And actually, someone's just said, does Sandy need any chainsaw help? I'd love to leave my phone and come and help her. We'll pass that on, whoever you are. Keep your texts coming in. 84844. Now, let's talk about the Breast Cancer Now Generations Study. It was set up in 2004 to help understand the causes of breast cancer. This 40-year landmark study is following over 110,000 women to understand why breast cancer develops. The study reaches its halfway point this month, and we've been following it on Woman's Hour since the start, checking in every decade. Now, it's looking at what causes breast cancer in pre- and post-menopausal women, and wants to unlock the knowledge needed to provide some of the 55,000 diagnoses, sorry, to prevent rather the 55,000 diagnoses that happen in the UK every single year. Delighted to say I'm joined by Professor Amy Berrington, co-leader of the study, and Amanda Jones, who is a participant and whose daughter Bex died of breast cancer in 2003, aged just 32. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you, Amanda. We're going to talk to Amanda first of all, and Amy in just a second. But Amanda, let's hear a little bit more about Bex. Who was she, and how did you get involved in this study?
She was the third of my three children, and probably the naughtiest. And she just sort of lightened up your life, you know. And all of us, absolutely all of us. In fact, I know nobody else can see this.
I can see it.
But you can see. I thought I'd bring her with me.
That's a lovely photo. And she's smiling into the camera and looking very relaxed. And, I mean, I read a little bit about her. She was a free spirit, wasn't she?
Yes.
Tell us about her going to France.
Yes, she went to France in her so-called holidays from university, doing, you know, a job of earning some money and working goodness knows where. And to put it briefly, she never came back because she fell in love, and he with her, with the owner of where she was working. And that was it.
And, I mean, that's just an incredible thing to do, isn't it? Were you worried at all? Did you say, are you sure you've made the right decision here?
Yes, I did. And I kept ringing up from time to time and saying, are you sure? Are you sure you're not going to come back? No, absolutely. We're going to be running the business together. And they just were for each other. And they had a wonderful time running the campsite in the summertime and going up and running a restaurant up in the mountains the rest of the time.
It was a short life, but it sounds like an incredible life. So utterly tragic to lose your daughter at such a young age. And how did you get involved in this study? Because it's so, so important.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I just cannot speak enough about it, really. I suppose, really, I got involved with it because when Bex died, I think, well, we were all, her brother and sister and I and everybody, was so shattered by it. I thought, I've just got to do something. I've got to find out something about this disease and how I could, in what way could I help? And I just rang up somebody I happened to know medically, and I said, look, what can I do? And he said, oh, well, you'll be surprised to know that we're actually starting a new fundraiser immediately called the 1,500 AIM. Why don't you just do that and see how you get on? I've been with the charities ever since.
Well, listen, let's bring in Professor Amy Berrington, co-leader of the study. Amy, welcome. I mean, since the study launched in 2004, you know, you've talked to people who've included family members of sisters, daughters, mothers who've had breast cancer. Where are you at with the study now at this halfway point?
Yeah, thank you. It's 20 years. It sounds like a really long time to be running a study. But for these sorts of studies where we want to understand what causes breast cancer, especially in younger women as well as older women, we do have to follow them for a really long time, collect all sorts of information on them. And so where we are now after 20 years is that have this 100,000 women who gave blood samples that we used to look at genetics. The women have provided survey information on their lifestyle in now 6 rounds of questionnaires, and medical history information, breast screening information. And so the idea is that you can put all of this together, and there have been sort of many findings already, but that also going forward, we can use new technologies and begin to use new methods to further sort of interrogate all of this information.
And so we're at the halfway point, a crucial point. What have you already found out?
So there have been lots of findings over the last 2 decades. I think a couple to highlight is the contribution the study has made to the understanding of the role of genetics in breast cancer. So now this study, combined with many others, have found more than 300 genetic changes that are related to an increased risk of breast cancer. These are common genetic changes. You can put these together and generate what we call risk scores to try and identify women that might be at particularly high risk of breast cancer. So I think that's one really important finding. And then 2 others about the risk of breast cancer in younger women, which is something that the study, was a sort of special feature of the study. So more than half the women were under the age of 50 when they joined the study 20 years ago. It was unusual to include so many young women. And then that enabled us to look at what causes breast cancer in young women, particularly before the age of 50. So one surprising finding was that actually women who have given birth seem to have an increased risk of breast cancer for a few years actually after they've had a baby. And that was a new finding, because sort of we always thought, and it's still true, that in the long term, the more babies you have, the lower your risk of breast cancer. That's about your risk of breast cancer when you're older. Mm-hmm. But actually in younger women, there is this sort of temporary increased risk of breast cancer, which is something new, I think, and something for women to be aware of.
Yeah, and also lifestyle as well. What did you discover on that?
Yeah, so absolutely. So a new finding from the study, again, combined with some other studies in the last couple of years, was about the role of exercise in younger women and preventing, looks like it can help prevent breast cancer again in younger women. It's already known that the exercise was good for preventing breast cancer in older women after menopause. But now we see that this is also something that's good at helping to prevent breast cancer in younger women.
And have you learned anything new about HRT, the kind of treatments women are on, the length of time they're on them, and how that maybe impacts on the potential for developing breast cancer?
Yeah, so in like quite a lot of other studies, the generation studies did find an increased risk of breast cancer in women taking HRT. Understand that this is can be a complicated issue for women, because we also know that HRT is extremely effective at helping menopausal symptoms. But and the good news, and something to emphasize, is that after women stop taking HRT, their risk of breast cancer begins to decrease again.
So on balance, the message is still, if you need to take it, take it. But maybe, you know, look at the length of time you're taking it for.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that the NHS guidance is quite clear that women who are suffering from menopausal symptoms particularly they need to talk to their doctor about their risk of breast cancer and also blood clots. But if they really are suffering from these menopausal symptoms, then the benefits should outweigh the risks. But then with the sort of additional message is, you know, once you think the symptoms have gone away, the advice is to stop taking it.
Just that brief look to the future then. The next phase, we're at the halfway point now. We've spoken to you at the start, 10 years, and now we're 10 years on, so at the halfway point. What does the future hold for the researchers? What will you be looking at? And will AI play a part in what's coming next?
Yeah, absolutely. So next 10 years, very exciting, the ability to use these new technologies and also new types of data we've been collecting. So we've been collecting mammograms, some of the women who've from their breast screening, and also breast tissue samples. And so we have images of the breast tissue samples and all these images of the breast from the mammograms. And that's where AI has this really amazing potential to look at patterns, that we humans can't see. And so perhaps to detect patterns in the mammograms, some of the images of the breast, see things that we can't see that might help predict women who are going to get breast cancer. And similarly, looking at the tissue samples, again, the ability to look at the tissue and for AI to find patterns that might predict risk.
Amanda, just final word to you. I mean, hearing all of that, I guess you think, thank goodness I was involved in this, and thank goodness that terrible loss, losing your daughter at such a young age, it spurred you to be involved in something so important as this study is.
Absolutely, Claire. I think that once I'd got over, we never get over losing her, but when life had to restart, I thought this is what I can do. And so from October of the year she died until here I am sitting here with you now, and thank you very much for inviting me. I've just been part of what's been happening, and I know that, and you've heard everything from just how everything's doing, and I mean it's quite amazing the advances that have been made, and I felt so blessed, as have my big children. We've just been it. This has been part of our lives, her death, but now the progress that is being made both by Generation Study and by Breast Cancer Now.
Well, listen, we're honoured to be part of it as well. Such an important day to mark the halfway point in this 40-year study. Thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you, Claire.
So lovely to meet you. Amanda Jones, participant in the study whose daughter Bex died of breast cancer in 2003, aged just 32. And our thanks to Professor Amy Berrington as well, who's co-leader of the study. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us on Woman's Hour today. Now, the trailblazing ballerina, Michaela Mabinty de Prince, has died at the age of 29. A spokesperson announced her death on Friday on her personal Instagram page, but a cause of death has not been given. Her story was quite honestly remarkable. She was born during Sierra Leone's Civil War, which took the lives of both her parents. She was sent to an orphanage where all the girls were given numbers. Michaela was number 27, considered the least favourite child. When she was 4 years old, she was adopted by an American couple and moved to the US, where her adopted family nurtured her love of ballet. Michaela made her way to the Dance Theatre of Harlem, the Dutch National Ballet, and performed alongside Beyoncé. She spent much of her career promoting the inclusion of black dancers in ballet. in 2015, Michaela spoke to Jenny Murray here on Woman's Hour and told her what her early life was like.
I can't remember what my father or my mother looks like, but I remember the feelings, and I remember, you know, I remember holding my father's hand and, you know, just always feeling safe. And that was the memory that I can always keep. You know, I'm just happy that I don't have to think about, oh, when they passed away, I can think about the happy memories.
But what impact did the Civil War have in the village?
A huge impact. There were bodies everywhere. You know, people were getting killed for absolutely no reason, and it was sad, and I had no idea what was going on, what was the reason. And for me, I've never accepted, you know, seeing bodies like that, and it was just absolutely horrible. And yeah.
But how do you deal with the memories of the horrors that you witnessed there? I mean, your teacher, Sarah, was pregnant and was brutally murdered right in front of you.
It's hard for me. And, you know, of course, you have to pretend to be strong. But really, I do have days where it's really, really hard for me. It's really hard for me to always talk about it. And sometimes I'll be on the phone with somebody having an interview. And it's just I have to make sure, you know, don't think about it. Don't think about it, because then I won't be able to sleep at night. I will have nightmares for a few weeks or a few days. And it's just it's hard to recover from. And I just try not to focus on it.
Now, you were born with a skin condition called vitiligo.
Yes.
And when you were taken to the orphanage, the children there were really cruel, saying they didn't want to catch your spots. How did you handle that?
You know, I just, like I said, you have to put a front and pretend that you're okay with people hurting your feelings. And, you know, of course, I had Mia, I had number 26 to save me. And she didn't care that, you know, I had spots, you know, it was pretty cool to her, I guess. And she was also left-handed, which is why she was number 26. So she and I got along well, and that's all I needed. I needed one person there.
And you and she shared a sleeping
mat. Yeah, she was my mat mate, and she used to sing to me every single night and tell me stories, and she ended up being my best friend, and then somehow we ended up getting adopted together.
I know that it was when you were in the orphanage that you saw a picture of a ballerina in a magazine. Why did it have such an impact on you then as a little girl?
She looked happy. And, you know, if it was a tennis player who looked happy, maybe I'd be doing tennis right now. But it was a ballerina. It was something I've never seen before. And it was this other creature. It was this inspiration. And it was light for me. It was hope. And inspired me to continue dreaming.
And how did you come to be adopted by the De Prince family?
I was lucky. Mia and I had the same first name. Her name was Mabinti and my name was Mabinti, but we had different last names. And so when my mom was talking to the agency, she was explaining how I want to adopt Mabinti. And they said, well, which one? She said, Mabinti, you know. And they're like, well, we have two. And there's this other girl, Mabinti Bangura, and nobody wants her because of her spots. And people are afraid that she's going to have self-esteem issues. And she's like, okay, let me see this girl. My mom also has vitiligo, and my mom used to teach for special ed, and she's worked with so many different types of people. So for her, it was like, oh, this is nothing. You guys are being dramatic. And so she said, okay, we'll take her too. So she calls my father, and he's in Japan at the time, and it's nighttime there, so he's sleeping. And she says, oh, there's this little girl. Do you think we can adopt her too? And he's like, yeah, sure, okay, yeah, that sounds good, and just hangs up. He calls her the next day and says, well, I had a strange dream and, you know, you said you want to adopt another child. And she's like, yeah, I have all the paperwork done and that's it. And that's how I got adopted.
How did you begin your ballet career?
Well, I started classes as soon as I came to the U.S. After I saw the Pennsylvania Ballet do Nutcracker, and I noticed that one of the girls messed up. And so that's, I think my mom realized this girl is a little obsessed with ballet, so maybe I should take her to classes. But I loved it. I love every single class. I worked as hard as I could, and, you know, a lot of teachers believed in me, and they pushed me, and I was always the youngest girl in my class, and I kept going.
Michaela Mabinti De Prince there, speaking to Jenny Murray back in 2015. And a family statement said Michaela was an inspiration to everyone who heard her story. Her family are also dealing with the death of her mother, Elaine, who adopted her from Sierra Leone, who also died this week in hospital. We pay tribute to both of them here on Woman's Hour. Now, my next guest is the only British woman to have played young Eponine and Fantine in Les Misérables. She's been nominated for 2 Grammy Awards and she's written a book that was on the Sunday Times bestseller list. And if that wasn't enough, she's also a new mum. But now she's heading out on tour, taking on one of her most challenging roles, playing herself. Carrie Hope Fletcher, nervous laugh.
Very nervous laugh.
Joins me. And I know you're in the welcome to Woman's Hour.
Thank you very much
and
for
I know
having me.
We're going to hear some live music in a moment. Malcolm's over on there on the piano. You're nicely warmed up, Malcolm. Are you okay over there?
I'm
That's a beautiful, oh, look at that beautiful setup over there. The music, I can't wait to hear you sing. I can't wait to hear you play. But let's talk about what you're doing, this Love Letters tour.
Yes.
Tell us about the idea behind it.
Yes, well, I'm just utterly petrified of being myself on stage, so I have to make it more like a show, which is where I feel the most comfortable, you know, acting and hiding behind a script. So we came up with this idea. I say we, me and my lovely team who helped me put this show together. We came up with this idea of writing love letters to people and things that I love, that, you know, we all love, whether it's, you know, someone or a thing like musical theatre or books or Disney in my case. We wanted to pay tribute to all kinds of love, whether it's maternal, platonic, unrequited, obsessive. But yes, also paying tribute to the, you know, the many, many things that we love as well. So I've written a series of love letters, and with each letter there is a song attached that I will dedicate to whoever or whatever the letter is written to. But the audience have influence over which letter and therefore which songs I sing on the night. The audiences are currently voting online for which letters I read, so it means that the set list is ever changing throughout the tour, which is absolutely terrifying.
Wow. Do they know what song is attached to which letter?
No.
Ah, because I was going to say, because you could end up singing the same song.
Exactly, yeah. So it's all completely sort of blind choosing. They're choosing the letters, but they have no idea which songs I will end up singing.
That's such a great idea.
Thank you.
Because you get them invested in the story.
And it's also just a lot of fun. It means that, you know, we're all you know, taking part in the show together, and we're all kind of creating this show as we go.
Very organic.
Yes, yeah.
And also you've asked for their stories too, is that
yes.
correct?
Yes, so the audiences are currently sending in letters, writing to whoever or whatever they want to write letters to. We've had a lot of people write in letters to people that are coming with them to watch the show who obviously don't know that they've written this letter. So one letter might be read out one night and it's to you in the audience because you're girlfriend, boyfriend, mum, sister, brother, whoever has come with you has written this letter in, and you will have a song dedicated to you on the night.
You're not doing any breakup letters, are you?
No, it's all about love. It's all about love.
Something, wouldn't it?
Absolutely not.
You're chucked. No, let's keep it on the positive. And what kind of letters have you been receiving? It sounds fascinating.
We've had some amazing ones, and the great thing is that we've had such a variety. You know, we've got the ones that we kind of expected to, you know, their mums or to their daughters and their children and that kind of thing, but we've also had letters to, you know, inanimate objects and feelings and to younger selves and future selves. It's been really amazing to see the vast array of letters that we've received.
Oh, it's such a great idea, as I say, because it's an engagement with the audience before they even walk in the theatre.
Yeah.
So listen, I'm going to get into talking about that a little bit more. And I know you're a new mum, so you're taking your daughter on the road with you. We'll talk about all of that. But you're going to perform.
I am.
So which one have you chosen to sing for us from the show?
Today I'm singing Journey to the Past from one of my favourite musicals, which is Anastasia.
Well, I'll let you take to the
I'm going to take a big glug of water before
take
I step up to
the mic. Take a big glug of water, absolutely. So, this is the wonderful Carrie Hope Fletcher and Malcolm on piano. This is Journey to the Past from Anastasia. Whoa, that was incredible. If you could do that at 10:45 on a Monday morning.
Oh, I mean, I've been up since 6, oh, so I've had a lot of warm-up.
We will get to that. That was just so lovely.
Oh, thank you.
Why does that song mean so much to you?
Anastasia was my favourite movie when I was growing up, to the point where when I was a kid I used to tell everyone my name was Anastasia just because I wanted to be her so much. So I feel like that song is sort of embedded in my soul. It's the song that I know, along with On My Own in Les Mis. Those two songs are like the songs that I could probably sing backwards if you asked me to, but please don't.
No, I won't. And you were just worried that you might forget the lyrics before you stood up there. But I mean, it's in your DNA, isn't it? Incredible. Let's talk then about you going out on the road, and you are a new mum. How old is Mabel?
She's 6.5 months.
Wow.
Yeah, super young still, yeah.
That is quite an undertaking.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a challenge. I know that it's going to be pretty tough, and I, you know, we're taking it day by day. You know, I've not committed to taking to her to the, you know, the full thing. If she's hating it and it's a real, real struggle, we'll figure something else out. But I also think that it's going to be a lot of fun. And, you know, what a thing to tell her and sort of, you know, when she's old enough to understand that when she was 6 months old, she came with me on tour.
Yeah. Who's coming with you? Who's
my
helping?
My mum's coming to help. Trusty mum. She's going to be there for the whole thing.
Oh, that's brilliant. Because your other half is in the business as well, isn't
he? He's currently playing King George in Hamilton.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let's give him a name check.
Joel Montague. That's my
Joel
husband.
Montague. And how does that work out? Because what a wonderful way What a wonderful creative career to have, but to have two parents doing that with a small child,
yes.
That's a juggle.
Yeah, trying to figure out the schedules is pretty difficult because, you know, we don't work the usual 9 to 5. We both work 6 till, well, when we get home is sort of like just before midnight, which, you know, isn't great when you've got a tiny baby who, you know, needs you to be there for the whole day. So we're very much, you know, juggling at the moment. He's currently taking care of her whilst I'm here. There'll be a crossover because he needs to be at work at 2:30 today. So we're going to quickly do a little tag team. So yeah, we're figuring it out. And, you know, we're not the first people to do this. The thing that sort of gives us hope is that there's so many of our friends, you know, people that we know in the business who are making it work with more than just one kid. So, you know.
Do you think that more needs to be, a light needs to be shone on that more? Though,
definitely.
About help for artists, for
yes.
musicians,
yes.
Who actually are working really antisocial, you mm-hmm. know, lifeblood of the, you know, creative cultural fabric of this country. And yeah, if you want to have a family, that's really hard.
It's really difficult, yeah. And I feel like there's this real mentality of the show must go on. You know, if you're not 100% into, you know, your job and, you know, you need to be really grateful to have the job that you have. And of course, everyone is so grateful, especially after the pandemic, to be working in the arts. And, you know, we all kind of had this reinvigorated sense of gratitude for what we do because it, you know, we missed it all so terribly when it was, you know, gone. Mm. But there also has to be a balance between life and family and working. And so, you know, we've taken massive steps as an industry. We're doing job shares now where, you know, new parents will do 4 shows. You know, there'll be 2 people cast in the same role and 1 person will do 4 shows and then tag team, but the next person will do 4 shows.
An understudy thing. That's
No.
It's incredible.
You know, they are both billed as the people playing those roles, which is, you know, huge. That's a huge step forward. But I do think there is a lot more that needs to be taken into consideration.
I'm interested to know, are you kind of withdrawn from Exhibit or you've handed your account over to your team to deal with? I know you're still on Instagram.
Yes.
But was that a move because you were, I don't know, fed up with the trolls or what was it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of negativity and it also feels like Twitter is very conducive to negativity. It feels like that was the one that I struggled with the most. So yeah, I just sort of handed that over just for my own sort of mental well-being, but also because, you know, when you're pregnant and you know that you've got a baby on the way and you kind of want to, you know, shield them from that as well, which is also why we don't post her on social media, because she's not for entertainment. You know, she's our child and she's a human being that we're bringing up in this world, and she's not for anyone else's entertainment, which is why we've kind of kept her away from it.
Yeah, Sandy Toksvig was saying just that in fact, we think it's a way of connecting with people. Being on your phone, mm-hmm. and being on social media can feel incredibly
isolating.
She was the one saying that's why she loves going out on tour, telling people get out, mm-hmm. you know, go to theatre, you know, and when you go in the interval, maybe just don't go to the toilet, maybe turn around and have a conversation with
yeah.
someone. Is that something you're hoping for as well, that
yes.
people will connect at your show?
Absolutely. Nothing makes me happier than when someone comes up to me and says, oh, I actually, you know, I'm here with my best friend, we met at the stage door of a show that we went to see you in 6 years ago. That's like, oh my God, knowing that something I had created has brought people together in that way is so wonderful. And of course social media can do that, but there is, you know, so much negativity in that as well. And you also find that what people say online, they would never say to your face in front of you when they would be able to see your reaction and how it's, you know, received. So yeah, I think I'd love it if people started chatting to each other at my tour. That'd be so wonderful.
And you are exposing yourself in a way. You say mm-hmm. you're always used to playing characters mm-hmm. and this is you getting up there and saying, okay, this is the personal stuff to me as well. How are you coping with that?
Well, I went on tour last year with sort of a similar concept of, you know, sharing stories and singing songs, and that was very much me on stage. And I was so nervous going up to it and so terrified about what this would mean and, you know, how I would feel being on my own on stage. And I actually had the best time, which is why I'm doing it again this year. But it is exposing. It is really vulnerable. But it's also, you find that those shows are also the most rewarding.
We've been talking about Chance Encounters. So many people getting in touch. Thank you to everybody. Elaine says, I got my first acting job via my butcher 45 years ago. I'm not at all well known, but I'm still a professional actor and I work. I'm a vegetarian these days, but forever grateful for the day I bought some chops and started my career. There's so many of these
that's
wonderful
brilliant.
Stories coming in. And I guess that's what you're hoping will happen at your shows too.
I would love that. I really, really hope that people, you know, meet future friends, future partners, who knows? It's a show all about love, so why not? Hope
excellent.
So.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you, Malcolm.
Yeah.
He's amazing. I know Malcolm's going out on tour with you as well. Look, I'm coming.
Iron Coming. That was incredible.
Thank
Carrie
you.
Hope Fletcher and Love Letters Tour kicks off Friday, the 27th of September in Guildford. That is it from Woman's Hour for today. Join me tomorrow for my interview with Kim Cattrall, best known for her character Samantha Jones in the US TV series Sex and the City. She's now starring in a new audio drama thriller, Central Intelligence, here on Radio 4. Talk to you tomorrow. That's all from today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Imagine a scrap of data that could help rescue a man lost at sea.
That far north, most people aren't found. This is a race against the clock.
Or expose staggering financial fraud.
All the Swiss banks, the British banks, the French banks. What I was looking at was a horror show.
Or uncover a medical breakthrough.
Within 10 years, the whole world was convinced that he was right.
10 extraordinary adventures of data and discovery. Uncharted with me, Hannah Fry, on Radio 4. Now available on BBC Sounds.